Because we just set something up with a gentleman named Ken Wilber.
Yes, yes. I've heard wonderful things of him and haven't met him.
Ken and I became very close friends 3 years ago. We met and just were writing a good fun time. And he created a chair of integral Judaism in Kabbalah at his Integral Institute. So I spend between my Israel community and between the Ken community. Those are the kind of the two communities.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So that's
wonderful,
my kind of entree into America.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the, just to give you like a little bit of the context and setting.
That's wonderful.
And what are other crossings? I read your husband's translations.
Oh, good.
Right.
Good.
I know. We could talk about Bhagavad Gita translation. Four questions which you say that you sometimes ask. And one is, can you see a reason to drop that thought? Right? And then is, can you find a stress-free reason to keep that thought? And that refrain, you know, appears, you know, by the way, the book is beautifully written.
Thank
so
you.
Hard to write an elegant
well,
book.
Well, that would be Stephen.
Right. Good for him. Can I marry him?
Well,
please?
Probably.
All right, well, we'll talk about that later, right? Can everyone please leave? Okay. So.
it would be a bodiless act.
I understand. We'll talk about that later. So it's a clear refrain, you know, something that doesn't cause you stress. And the question is, you know, let me kind of push a little bit in the most gentle, loving way. Is that a fair question? In other words, is the assumption that seems to run through the work that I want to be stress-free, peaceful, and harmonious? I mean, it's great, but maybe I want to live life in creative tension.
Yes.
Yeah.
So good. Yeah.
Right? So.
So it's just a question.
Okay.
And it's marvelous for a person to know. It's like a showdown with yourself, all of these questions. It's do I want to be stress-free? Well, how many people really stop to think about it? Maybe they don't yet. So it's just a question, and there's no motive sought after with these questions. And the second one is, can you absolutely know that it's true?
Right.
Rather than the way you phrased it the first time.
Uh-huh. It's a very bad idea for me to try to phrase the work correctly in front of the person who did the work. That would be that's an absolutely true bad idea.
Right? Yeah.
So I stand corrected in everything from the outset. So tell me the better phrasing and what.
Well, the phrase you used, it wasn't open enough. It wouldn't be open enough for me to answer. It would be leading.
Okay.
And whereas, can you absolutely know that it's true, leaves the person some space to answer it for themselves without being led.
Without being led. Okay. So staying with stress for a second.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying stress is just a methodology question, and the sense that you get from the book is really, you're saying, really actually mistaken, right? That is to say, the notion that what we're looking for is stress-free reasons or a stress-free life,
yeah,
or the move beyond stress is not really a legitimate axiom. That's really what I wanted to play with.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm not aware of anywhere in the book that it even recommends being stress-free.
Okay. I'll give you a sense. I'll give you a sense, you know.
It certainly could be read that way, though.
But
like stress-free is the best way.
Like stress-free is the best way.
Stress-free.
Right. There's a lot of stress-free happening. So good. So that's really important to know, because I actually raised this with my students and I said I would ask you.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things I've tried to teach them was, don't read a book and make assumptions, ask.
Yeah,
right?
Very good.
Uh-huh. Right? Because one of the things we're trying to teach in this Kabbalistic idea is that Noah could be the stress-free guy, but he also could be, remember Kurt Vonnegut's son, Mark Vonnegut, wrote a book called Eden Express. It was about going back to Eden in order to avoid all the stress. Right? So let me go back to the womb. Mm-hmm. Which actually is kind of a regressive move. And it's actually, life has tension, we all know that. It has tension, it has creative mm-hmm. tension. And sometimes, even if I can't find a stress-free reason to hold on to a belief, I might find three really good stress reasons.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Clearly.
Yes.
Okay, good. No, that's really important. That's really helpful. Uh-huh. That's really helpful. So if I find three good stress reasons, that's a good enough reason to keep the belief.
Yeah. And if someone wanted to go back to Eden, I found it to be a journey, that if we skip the journey when we get back to Eden, it might not be, I mean, how would we know what it is?
So the journey itself, if I'm listening in right, the journey itself actually has its tension. And if I skip the journey and skip the stress, I might not actually be in Eden.
Yes, or you wouldn't recognize it if you were, which is what I'm finding with the mind, you know, as mind identifies it, as we are in Eden. And because we believe what we think, we just haven't realized it yet. In fact, mind would tell us not.
Okay, so we are in Eden, right? Beautiful. Mm-hmm. So any good non-dual Kabbalist would say, would completely be with you on that. All right, we are in Eden. We need to free the mind in order to realize where we are. Right?
And how do we free the mind as long as the mind believes what it thinks?
And how do we free the mind as long as the mind believes what it thinks?
It's not possible.
It's not possible. Okay. So here's...
That's what makes up the construct of a mind. And if we didn't believe our thoughts, how could we identify as a this, a body?
A this about a story.
Yes.
A story. So the question then becomes, and again, I'm fully aware of the limitation of the written word, which is why I came for a conversation, mm-hmm. because written words are frozen, and they don't have the living flexibility and texture and aliveness. Mm-hmm. So that's why I told my students I actually couldn't give a talk on this based on the written word. I had to talk to you. So I'm actually really, because what I would have done, for example, is I would have given a 45-minute talk about, you know, why finding a stress-free reason, right, is actually a bad axiomatic assumption because some reasons have stress in them. So now we've cleared that one up. So now let's go to the idea of what I want to try and call levels of consciousness, right? In other words, in Kabbalah, we have this very wonderful idea that there are many levels of consciousness that people live on. So for example, I live on a consciousness of duality. In duality, so Gafni's here, Katie's there, we're two completely separate people. That's a legitimate level of consciousness.
Yes.
And if I do anything to violate those boundaries, I'm in clear violation. And you've got these two big people here who can kind of knock me out or call room service. Okay, right? And yet there's another level, which I felt when I first met you, the very first second was, well, we're clearly part of the same field of reality. Yeah. You know, different stories, different histories, but somehow weaving a web which is part of the same web, and we're interconnected and we're part of this non-dual oneness. Now those are both true. If I would let go of one or the other, I'd be missing a face of God.
So, of course, what I think and hear is always being questioned. So it's like the two of us meet, and then you give two examples of how we meet, and those would only be true for you.
Okay.
We never know who we're meeting.
We never know who we're meeting. We never know who we're meeting.
So when you say that's how we meet, that's how you meet me.
That's my experience of meeting you.
Uh-huh. And we're all one, for me, would be if I were new to that concept or even old to that concept, if I didn't have my own thought about it, and I heard that, it's my goodness, how could I wrap my mind around such a concept? We're all one.
Right.
When I see separately, and what does that mean? You know, we're all one. It just seems like so much.
So big.
So much for anyone to try to comprehend something. In fact, they can't.
Which means that I have to fall back, in my experience, right, to duality. And it's hard to live always in non-duality. It's hard to live at that place of experiencing us being in the interconnected web, although we have flashes of it, you know, in a hug, in a grace, you know, in tears.
But if you're living in it, it would be hard not to.
And we sort of move in and out of it, right? In other words, we sort of move kind of,
Well, what if we don't?
Well, okay, so go, that is to say, what if we're always in it?
It's like, how can you be both?
So again, we're just beginning grasping for language here. So we're just saying,
who
are these people talking? So we're just to go slow. So,
okay. So different levels of consciousness.
Different levels of consciousness.
We both see that clearly.
We see that clearly, and
now duality. What is duality to you? So you use terms that until I know what they mean to you, I have no meaning. they hold no meaning.
So let me play with it. Good. So let me actually give you a couple of examples. What would duality mean to me, and why would it be important, duality or non-duality?
What is it?
So for example, duality in Kabbalah says that in this face of God, there's me and you, there's me and you, there's me and the world. We're dual, we're two. And from that place, I need to exercise judgment. From that place, I need to exercise discernment. Right? So that's the beginning of duality.
And I would say that that's true if you hold you, whoever that may be, hold any self-love whatsoever.
Help me, double click for me.
Well, it would by, like, there's me and there's you.
Right.
And I can't remember your words, but basically the way I see you, this duality, the clearer I am, the kinder my thoughts are
right.
about you,
right.
the kinder the experience for me.
And the softer the lines get.
Absolutely.
And the softer the lines get.
It's self-love. It's like we're awake to our nature. You know, our nature, which for me, God to me is synonymous with good, with goodness, with kindness. And the reason that I have come to believe that is any thought that would say that there's less than that feels like stress. There's that word again,
right?
It feels stressful. So that so I say that stress, the feelings of stress, it's like a little temple bell. It lets us know that the thoughts I am having about you are something that I need to look at, that I'm out of alignment with what's true, what's true to my nature, and as mine projects everything true to your nature too. However, we all have different realities.
Okay, so let me try and play with it for a second, okay? When I say duality and non-duality, and this is not actually an abstract conversation, I'm going to try and bring it very, very down into the book and into specific examples, but I'm just trying to kind of dance here before we get here. When I say duality and the experience of duality, there's part of the experience of duality that its loss causes stress, right? That is to say, one face of God is the face of discrete individual people interacting with each other, and actually relationship comes from, you know, love comes from also my ability to love you. When we become one, I lose that relational piece. I lose what we call the I thou.
Yes.
You know, when I'm into the I am, when we're all part of the I am, there's no I thou. So that's enormously important, duality. And duality also says, and here's a really, really huge idea in Kabbalah, that when I face a world that doesn't match the vision that my experience, discernment, judgment, meditative vision, experience that it should be, and I'm using the word should here, the world should be good. People should be more loving, right? People shouldn't be starving.
So what you're seeing isn't matching everything you just named.
Right. So therefore, what I do, what does the prophet do? What does Isaiah do or Jeremiah do? Isaiah cries out, in quotation marks, against God and says, God, how can you allow a world of such suffering? Right? And the act of protest, right, is this great divine shout, which fuels social change, which fuels protest, which fuels transformation.
Now that assumes
right.
that without that
That's
thrust
Jeremiah.
Of feelings, it assumes that all of that would not happen anyway.
Right. So here's the great thing. So here's just this great, what we call chavruta point. This is a great point to kind of push back and forth on with no one being right. It's just two different
yes.
perspectives of the divine. So the way you would talk about it in the book, I mean, I could find a couple of quotes, but I mean, it's all over the book, is basically something like, you know, in the end, love will make it work. You know, love will cause social change, right? That'll kind of, you know, move it, you know, one way or the other.
Is my goodness.
Page 1, I'll give you an example.
I need to rewrite that book.
I'll give you an example, right? So there's a whole series of things in the book here where basically you take on people who say, things shouldn't be this way. My father shouldn't hit me. You know, people, you know, should be more loving, you know. So all those shoulds you take on as being somehow not in alignment, right, with a higher reality.
Okay.
So when a Kabbalistic thinker reads that, he says, what's she talking about? Oh, my God. What does that mean? Right? What happened to Jeremiah? Right? Yeah. Do you follow? You see where I'm coming from?
Yes.
Right? In other words, I'm just give you you know, a couple of examples. They're just kind of fun to see. They're total fun. You know, so like on page 90, so we talk about people, you know, should be more loving, you know, right? People should be more loving. And I would see that they caused a feeling of uneasiness, right? They caused a feeling of stress, right?
That thought
people should be more loving.
My thought.
Right.
People should be more loving.
Right.
If that causes stress within me
right.
in that moment.
We're back to stress. You notice that?
It's a feeling,
right?
Uh-huh.
Right. But maybe that should cause stress, right? Maybe that dissonance.
It does if you believe it.
But maybe you should believe it.
Well, people do. So
That's good.
If you look in the book, it
right.
says that how do I know people should
right.
think that way? They do.
My father shouldn't hit me. Shouldn't have hit me, right? You know, a page before, it's the same theme. In other words, what I would ask is, and this is a genuine question mark. There's questions that really are statements disguised as a question. This is a real question with a real question mark at the end, right? In other words, the way I teach the tradition is, and I'm totally open to see how else I could teach it, is when someone says my father shouldn't have hit me, that's a good point.
Yeah, and the world would agree.
Right? Your father actually shouldn't have hit you.
Yeah, and now actually, we're all angry at the father.
Right? And that's okay.
And yeah, that's okay.
And actually may even be good.
Yeah.
It's actually legitimate,
it's not
sacred
only okay,
anger.
Okay, it could be good for many people, and is it good for you? That's the point. Is anger good for you? Is that what you want in your life? And if it is, you're in the right world.
Right. So the question is, here's where it's taking us like 25 minutes, but that's what it should take, because we're slowly narrowing down on this point. Yeah. In other words, a Jeremiah mystical consciousness or an Isaiah mystical consciousness would say, you know, I'll give you an example. I'll give you a great example. One of the first Hasidic stories I ever heard from my grandfather. It's a beautiful, beautiful story about Levi Isaac of Berdichev, and it's Yom Kippur, right, the holiest day of the year, and this man pushes his way to the front of the synagogue, and he mumbles a few words and walks out, and the disciples want to kill him because he's violated the sanctity of the day, and the Rebbe, who's a true master, says, well, I want to know what he prayed. I mean, how did he have such audacity to pray, and me, I can't muster that. So he's called back to the master at the end of services, and the master says, what did you pray? He says, well, you know, it was really simple. I said to God, you know, I've had a bad year. I've done this wrong, and I've done a little cheating, and I wasn't quite honest about this, and I've had a bad year, and I need forgiveness. But you, God, you had a horrible year. The widow I've heard crying every night, right? And he goes through all the suffering in Berdichev, and he says, but I'm a good Jew. I'll make you a prayer should be, and he adds a sentence to the end of the story. He says that what I said to that Jew who made that deal with God is, I said to him, Shoita, fool, you made one mistake. Had you prayed in the plural and not in the singular, it would have brought redemption to the world. So that's a certain ethos. It's an ethos of challenging God. That's why is that person suffering next door? God, that shouldn't be. And there's a strong should. And when Abraham stands before God in Sodom, he says, will the judge of the whole world not do justice? There's a strong should there. And kind of the Hebrew mystical ethos is powered by a should, right? And that should animates a person in the world. And when I read the book, you know, there were three thoughts that ran through me. First off, I was madly in love with it, and still am.
Good.
And I'm not, as you know, you'll hear from Ken or from, I'm not a knee-jerk, it's gorgeous. The book is gorgeous, right? And it clearly allows a person to accomplish a very particular mystical goal, which is achieving a level of non-duality, right? And it's when I achieve a level of non-duality, I can't challenge God. What is what is. Every place you've been, you need it to be. And we call that sweetness in
yeah.
Kabbalistic not so.
Well, it's sweet when you can see that.
It's sweet when you can see that,
yeah.
Right? And the Baal Shem Tov, right, the Hasidic Mash says that's sweetness. So this whole book gorgeously expresses better than many Hasidic books that tried, and I'm going to assign it to my students when they're learning that level of consciousness, teaches people how to access hamtaka, sweetness, the non-dual sweetness of reality.
Good.
And yet, and here's the and yet, and here's the kind of wonderful paradox, what I found kind of challenging to me in the book, from not to anyone, just to me, from my tradition that I'm trying to share, teach myself, is in a certain sense what I would call the lack of paradox. That is to say, we're operating only at sweetness, but we're not operating at the level before that, you know, we call havdalah, which is separation, duality, individuation, where I challenge God, where I engage stress, because that leads me to healing and transformation, where I engage sacred anger, where I engage all those things as essential dimensions. And
but doesn't it challenge it? Like, the world is a terrible place, and a lot of people would agree with that statement.
Would you?
No.
So let's work on that for a second. Can we work with that?
Sure.
Let's play with that, right?
So, sure. So the world is a terrible place. Is that true? Can you absolutely know that it's true?
So what I would say is parts of the world, right? You know, the world is a terrible place is too big, of course, because we're having this beautiful conversation. So that couldn't be happening in a terrible place.
Yeah.
But parts of the world, for example, when my mother was buried alive at age 3 and crawled her way out of a grave, and an entire family was killed, right, you know, in Stanislav, that was terrible. Actually, that was terrible.
Did you ask her?
I did. She mentioned it.
But when did you ask her to go back as a 3-year-old, as she's crawling out of the grave, if she had any thoughts at all? And if she did, what were they? And that tells you the experience she had. Maybe she didn't even know it was a grave until people told her later, so it wasn't a horror until later.
She figured it out.
So, good. So that 3-year-old is maybe just taking a little stroll outside.
So let's push on this, because this is so exciting, just to be able to really to push this issue through. When I say push, I mean gently push.
Okay, so,
right?
So here's gently.
Go.
I ask you, the world is a terrible place. Is it true? And then you bring your mother into it. You bring all the proof. Now, that's what the mind does. That's its job. Because the world's a terrible place. And immediately, the mind as a seeker will give all the evidence.
Right.
Boom, 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 boom. That holds it up. So you have time and space and place. And that's how it stays intact.
Right.
So if you just notice that,
right,
and move back to the 4 questions, okay, just notice your mind does that, just comes in with all the
right
proof, and just say, that's brilliant, brilliant, now let's answer the question, then you can have your life mind.
Right.
Okay, so then
so
the world
parts,
is a terrible...
Parts of the world are terrible places.
Okay, now, if you had to say
right
yes or no,
mm-hmm,
the world is a terrible place.
Parts of the world are terrible places.
And if you had to answer, you see, this is where the work takes you into your heart.
But let's play for a second, okay? And I'll play in any court, because I just want to press towards truth here, right?
Okay, and what am I doing when I ask you to answer? Like, if God were watching you...
You're framing a question, but whenever you frame the question, so then the person's engaged at that question. So what I want to do is, instead of answering your framed question, let me set up my statement.
Very good.
Right?
Very
so,
good.
So my statement would be, parts of the world are terrible places.
Good.
Right?
Good.
That would be my statement.
Good. Okay.
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 So you're playing it safe.
Right? I'm playing it honest. Right?
Okay.
See, in other words,
honest to what you know without being still in it.
See, here's the question. Here's the question. In other words, when a person writes out their worksheet, okay,
they're going to do what you're doing.
Right. And by the way, if at the end of this dialogue, we for every reason we don't like it, we can kind of get rid of it. So we don't have to do anything
this
with it.
Is,
okay.
This
so
is
so a, I want
good.
I want to feel totally open. There's no
okay.
It can just stand
but
totally
I love,
fine.
I love what you're saying, because you're saying everyone has a right to their questions, whether it's superficial, whether it's deep, whatever it is. I mean, a right to their answers, whether it's superficial, wherever it comes, they have a right to that. So I'm with you 100%.
Right. So I would never say the world's a terrible place. I would say, right, terrible things happen in the world.
Okay.
Right?
Okay. So what about, let's get one that has some meat in it, okay? People shouldn't hit each other. Is it true? People shouldn't strike each other.
See, again. So here again, and here's where we're gonna have like a great chavruta, means push back and forth. See, I think where you can find the truth of it actually, right, is in the places right, of suffering, right? And the suffering issue kind of is a theme, you know, again, again, and again in the book.
Okay, so let's go into it.
Let's stay with pain.
Good. Okay. So the world is a terrible place. What question would you use?
Terrible things happen in the world. Some parts of the world.
This is juicy.
Good. Let's do it.
Terrible things happen in the world. Is that true?
Yes.
Terrible things happen in the world. Can you absolutely know that it's true that terrible things happen in the world?
Yes.
And how do you react when you think that thought? How do you react when you believe the thought, terrible things happen in the world?
I cry. I'm devastated by the infinite pain in the world, right? And when I'm devastated by the infinite pain in the world, so I try and do two things. I try and cry with the world, to cry with the Shekhinah, with the goddess, and I try and change the world. I try and heal it and transform it, which is why I'd never want to give up that feeling.
And we move to the next one.
Great.
So we have everything in common. So who would you be without this thought, terrible things happen in the world?
I would be a person who taught a Torah that wouldn't feel honest and aligned to me.
Now, as someone facilitating you, I would write that down.
Okay.
And then I would ask you to question that later. Without that thought, you would not be a helpful person. Can you absolutely know that that's true?
Answers, I would say yes. Yes.
So now let's move back to the other.
Okay.
Okay. So terrible things happen in the world.
Okay.
So turn it around. Turn the thought around. Find opposites.
Well, in terrible, the turnaround, right, in the book would be...
Just find an opposite. Terrible things happen.
Great things happen in the world.
Okay.
Clearly true.
Yes. So give me an example of a terrible thing that is great, that turns out to be great. Give me three examples.
Right. See, here's the other side. There are sometimes terrible things do turn out to be great. That's true.
What if it weren't sometimes?
So let me throw out to a scene.
Okay.
Okay. Let's go back to like literature for a second. Do you remember there's this great scene in Brothers Karamazov, where there's a general, you know, on his horse, and there's a boy and his mother, and there's a pack of dogs, and the boy throws a stone at the dog. The general gets angry, and he tells the boy to run, and he sends the dogs after the boy, and the dogs rip the boy apart in front of the mother, and then Ivan, right, and Alyosha have this conversation where basically, you know, Ivan says to Alyosha, you know, his son who's a priest, he says, I don't want to be there when they explain to me why good came from this, right? I don't want to be there when Jesus embraces, right? And that's basically, right, my only response to this is radical absolute protest.
Yes.
Right? And that's the only way I can hold my humanity. Right?
Yes, it is.
Right, right?
Humanity as we know it.
Right, humanity as we know it, as we know it. And so that's what I mean by levels of consciousness.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a level of consciousness at which everything that is needed to be, which would mean that would have to include everything, right, including that. And there's a level of consciousness that needs to live at the same time, which is radical, absolute protest.
I agree.
Right? And that paradox, that, you know, dialectic, sorry for that word, that, you know, push and pull,
I agree up until now that's true.
Go ahead, help me. Tell me more.
Well, I believe that we have to, you know, that this radical protest has to live in the world because that is reality. That's the way of it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that's always going to be the way.
Tell me more.
Well, I don't know a lot about Jesus, but what I do know is people who are very clear, I don't know what you call them, or how you'd refer them to, but people who can just see.
Right.
Okay. Don't live that way. They have found another way. And because they have, it doesn't mean that, and they're not radically protesting. these people didn't radically protest.
See, I think they did.
You're probably right.
You are so delightful and charming.
You're probably right.
That it's kind of...
Yeah, because I can't think of one. I don't have any knowledge of it.
So I'm going to tell you, the same gentleman, Levi Isaac of Berdichev, who we told the story about before, he was a complete non-dualist. He would get up in the morning and cry out, God, I don't want your Torah. I don't want your commandments. I just want you. I just want you. I just want you.
Uh-huh.
Everything that is, everything that God does is for the good.
Yes, it is.
He was complete, right? Everything that God does is for the good. That same Levi Isaac of Berdichev, in Berdichev, in the mid-19th century, held a trial. And he had a seat there. And he had witnesses from Berdichev to see if God was guilty. And in the end, they concluded that God was guilty. I don't know what the sentence was. Right?
Yeah, well, they would have to conclude that God is guilty because they're perceiving out of their own guilty heads.
So here's the paradox, and here's the wonderful paradox that I want to share, even as I receive back this kind of gorgeous everything that is, you know, is, and we love what is because that's what needs to be. At the same time,
what I say is that's because it is.
Because it is.
Mm-hmm. Turn the third
schedule. Yeah. Yeah, we should, the room's kind of heating up. It's cooling down. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is, can we hold both? And it's what I'm inviting us to is, can we hold both and not preference one over the other? That is radical protest and radical embrace.
Well, I can hold it. I seem to be holding it as long as you're the one doing the radical protest.
Yeah. And that is sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's infinitely sweet even.
And if it's really sweet, that's all you have to project as a future.
Right.
So life is sweet.
Yes, no but, and. And at the very same time, I say, right, and I would say, oh my God, it's so true, right?
Yeah, we can see that's been your path
right
up to now. But so just for the sake of moving through it.
Let's move through it.
You have to save the world. What was your phrase?
I participate in the healing and transformation of the world.
Okay, so if we take the shortcut and we turn around to everyone participates.
Beautiful.
And whatever the word was, the world.
Right, healing, transformation, whatever.
Yes, then you have the man with the leaky bucket.
Right.
How else can the flowers grow?
Right.
He's transforming, not only is he transforming the world, he's allowing it to live. So that's a very beautiful thing. And then to move back to the little girl crawling out of the grave, she may have been having the most wonderful experience, no better or worse than before she started digging her way out. That could have been her. She could be loving that experience, but people watching it, they tell the story mentally of what that little girl is suffering, and then they have this horrible experience. And then they teach the little girl she had a terrible experience, but maybe it wasn't terrible for the little girl.
Can I ask you a question? Is it true? Is it really true?
I don't know.
But, I mean, is it really true that you really, I mean, no, just you and me, that you really believe that a girl crawling her way out of a grave, or any
other... She doesn't know it's a grave.
But could it be that there's suffering that's just profound, and the person experiences that profound, deep, real suffering that's
they
a violation
do.
Of the God?
They do. I don't see it as a violation of the God. I see it's innocence. It's just pure innocence. But I see that people do. They suffer in the way that you're talking about.
Because
all over the world.
Because they have a mind construct that's wrong, or because there's
not
been some
wrong.
Defacing of reality?
Oh, never a displacing of reality. That's not possible. But the mind that would attach a story to reality is how reality
right.
appears to be displaced.
Right.
It's just simply mind believing what it thinks and mirrors out a world of suffering, basically.
Right. So that's really how you get to. I totally hear. I mean, I'm hearing much more deeply. So in the beginning of the book, you have this fabulous sentence, which we have to give Stephen some credit for phrasing, but your idea. I'm telling you, sure he won't marry me? I'm telling you, I need some.
Well, I think it's too late. I think we have.
You've got it. All right. All right. I'm kind of bummed, but all right. So page six, right, you talk about this beautiful thing. I have never experienced a stress-free feeling that wasn't caused by attaching to an untrue thought.
Yes.
Right? Behind every uncomfortable feeling, there's a thought that isn't true.
Yes.
Right? And so when you talk about the examples you give, the wind shouldn't be blowing, my husband should agree with me, well, that works. Right? What I'm kind of asking is, you know, could it be that these examples are kind of drawn from a particular kind of, how should I say it? The normal suffering of normal people, right? There's what I would call the normal suffering of normal people.
Yes.
And then there's the horrible suffering when the world kind of just explodes.
Yes.
And then that horrible suffering, as we both know, is taking place at this very moment all around the planet. We're just not participating.
I know about seemingly unbearable suffering.
And it was,
you know, I understand that.
And that's pretty stressful, and it's not caused by attaching to an untrue thought.
I was believing my thoughts.
Okay, so I said this is really great, because what we're seeing here, I think what I'm seeing is that these really are two different paths, and they're complementary paths. In other words, I'm holding the truth and the gorgeousness of this path. The work, when I was with the Gurdjieff people, by the way, they said, the work, oh my God. I'm sure that you must get that a lot.
Yeah, well, I said, a couple of times.
I recommended
in Europe.
I recommended it to them. I told them it's a good next step. So they're gonna go read it, these sweet people. But what I'm actually saying is, do we need to beware of absolutizing one level of consciousness and making it
no.
the only face of God? Right, and you say no.
No.
Right.
You know, because people don't. We don't.
Mm.
And I've come to see that where we are all one is in our stressful thoughts. In every language of the world, they're the same, and I have done some traveling.
Oh, yeah.
I have seen not one new stressful thought in 63 years, not one. So we are battling, you know, and as long as we believe those thoughts, we're like dinosaurs, we're like ancients, still battling with the same stressful thought. We're not battling with the world, it's our thoughts about the world, and until we can understand our thoughts, how can we understand the world? Our mind is what creates the world. You know this.
Right. No, I.
So it leaves no world to work with.
Right.
It leaves mind to work with. But as long as I hold what I believe to be you,
mm-hmm.
or your mother, or these suffering people, you know,
mm-hmm.
that I sit with or are across the globe.
Right.
You know, as long as I am focused on bodies, how can my mind ever find resolution? And my mind is what spins these identities out, and there's no peace in it. And I don't ever for a moment believe these people aren't suffering. I had that experience at a level that I'd say killed me.
Mm.
And so I'm left as...
That's the 1986 story.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And so I'm left with what we can deal with, and that is the mind. There is the mind at war with itself, and as long as the mind is at war with itself, there's war on the planet, because what it projects is what we see. And that can't be told. You know, that's something that has to be realized, and that's the simplicity of, you know, when I ask you, I can't remember the sentence we were working with, but terrible things happen in the world.
Right.
And you give me an answer so quickly. You know, I could sit with that and did for days and days and days and days in the quiet until I found resolution, you know, or a maybe, just a maybe. the open mind, open heart, closed mind, closed heart.
You see that question, and I completely hear the, well, let me go a step at a time. That question, do terrible things happen in the world, is a question that I sat with for years and years and years, and at a certain point, almost couldn't move until actually when I was like 34, I kind of stopped and just poured out a 400 or 500 page book on evil and uncertainty, you know, in a Hebrew book. It's actually now being translated in order to allow myself to kind of live in the world, both embracing the world, embracing what is, and at the same time holding the radical protest.
Yes. Now, what I find interesting is you said, do terrible things happen to the world? And what I said is, terrible things happen to the world. Mine is just, whoa, it's direct.
Terrible things happen in the world.
Yes.
We agree on that?
Terrible things happen in the world. You know, I believe...
Which are not the result of people being trapped in their thoughts.
I believe... No.
In other words, of course, everything does go back to a person being trapped in their thoughts because the person doing evil is clearly doing evil because he or she is trapped in their thoughts. So that we're all trapped in our thoughts, you know, as the psalmist says, you know, Rabot machshavot b'lev ish, right? There are many thoughts in the mind of the human being, but in the end, you have to free yourself from them. Vatzat Adonai hitakum, right? In the center of God is what stands.
Yes.
That's your teaching. And that's a gorgeous teaching. And so I hold that teaching with...
It's a gorgeous reality.
Right. The teaching expresses the reality, right?
It's not at war with anything.
Right.
With nothing. You know, my mantra, if I had one, it's I love God. I love God. I love God. I'm God's will. And as all one, we're God's will.
And
the nature, you know your nature. You
gorgeous.
Know your nature. You're living your life as goodness.
So the Kabbalist's mantra would be, I love God, I love God. Therefore, the voice of God within me challenges evil. I love God, I love God. Therefore, the voice of God within me moves towards participating in the healing and transformation of the world. I love God, I love God. So the God within me puts God on trial and demands justice.
Okay. So that the second one, I love God because, what was that? Just before the last one.
The second one.
The world.
Right. I love God, I love God. And therefore, I participate in the healing and transformation of the world as an expression of God.
And I did too. In my world, and then as I healed my world, I understood your world. So it's all one world. I mean, there's just no time and space in it. It's the beginning, the middle, the end. Now.
You know, the truth that's kind of coming down at the second is something that you said, you know, some, you know, 20 minutes ago. You know, it could be, you know, what I came in thinking was that, and that's what I teach my students and probably will continue to, that we all have to kind of hold the different levels of consciousness. You offered a different model, which was maybe different people hold and incarnate and personify in the world different levels of consciousness.
Well, if we're all one,
Then the organism is expressing it in all in different
yes.
ways. Of course, who knows what we're all one means, as we said in the beginning, but whatever that means. So so loving what is, right, holds powerfully the story of Zusha of Anipo, the Hasidic master, who's like living in complete poverty. And his brother says to him, how can you live like this? And he says, what do you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
This is just the sweetness of God. Oh my God, right?
Not only that, look what I have.
Look what I have,
yeah.
Right? Loving
like,
what is.
It's like I have everything you do, I just don't have the mortgage.
Right. Loving what is, which is a powerful, powerful lived experience, truth in the world. And for a world caught in victimhood, you know, all over the world, it seems like the work is a hugely powerful tool also to free people from their thoughts and from their victimhood. What I would just share is, no but, there's no but here, just an and, is that we need another teaching in the world at the same time, right? And that teaching doesn't come to in any way, God forbid, undermine sweetness, which is what a gorgeous place to live, but it says that together with sweetness is the level of consciousness, right, which is the second face of God. And in the second face of God, right, there's protest and there's sacred anger, right, and there's challenging what is, right, even challenge the actual divine reality. And when I challenge the divine reality, it's God speaking.
But as long as we have believe what we think, we're going to have anger and righteous anger and plenty of people to agree with us. And in that, we're allowed to keep anger. And in that, it's like they are wrong and I am right, and look at all the people backing me. Therefore, I'm right.
Right. So
I mean,
so,
it's you know what I'm hearing is valid reasons to be angry and protest.
So let me
ask. And life just goes on.
Are there ever valid reasons to be angry and protest?
Well, we believe that there are until we begin to sit down and question them, and look at other options, which is the turnaround, and finding examples of those turnarounds.
And when I get to the turnaround, I give up all anger?
No. Who knows what you do when you question and turn it around? Who knows?
Maybe could there be a distinction between what I would call, let's make up a term right now, I would call fallen anger, pseudo anger, and sacred anger, which actually is critical and essential, deployed in the right way to the living fulfillment of my life, and without which I'm missing something essential.
Anger is violent. Would you agree with that? Feel it. When you're really angry, I'm not talking about intelligent protest. Anger, that is stressful. That is violent. Would you agree to that?
Absolutely. And I would agree that violence is sometimes an attribute of express divinity.
Well, I would say you're absolutely right. Now let's move back to this anger, that it is violent.
I'm with you.
Okay. It's as though we believe that without that anger and violence, that there would be no motivator to do what is kind and resourceful and intelligent. And my experience is it's absolutely not true.
Because love can be that motivator.
Well, imagine the violence and anger, how much energy that consumes. Well, what if you were doing what you do in the world, or a scientist, or a builder, or a genius? Imagine, or any of us, imagine what we could do in our life without the energy being burned in anger, and stress that brings, and the violence. Imagine
stress.
The energy.
Bad.
Imagine the energy that creativity would be available to creativity.
Right. So if you hear, let me totally hear that, and let me in chavruta, right, that kind of sacred play, kind of gently push back with a Hebrew word. In Hebrew, the word for intimacy and love, right, chom, and anger, chema, is the same word, right? That is the split between those two. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yes, but I can see why it's the same word, because we are always justified in our anger.
Or
it's like, I'm only angry at you, sweetheart, because you ran into the street and the car could hit you. I love you. See, it comes, everything comes out of love.
Or,
there's nothing that it's not.
Or, right, they're related because actually what motivates sacred anger, right, actually is love, right? In other words, the ability, I mean, what's the Exodus story? It's the ability to stand against the status quo and say, it doesn't need to be that way. I mean, what is divinity? Right, divinity is the possibility of possibility.
So what is a criminal that does not think it doesn't have to be the way that it is? My family's hungry and I've got a habit and I'm going to rob the man next door and feed my family. You know, it's all
absolutely
what you name.
So again, what we come back to is kind of this, right? Let me say it this way. At level two consciousness, which I'm calling separation, individuation, protest. So we say greater is good than evil, greater is light than darkness. At level three consciousness, sweetness, represented by Zushi of Anipol and Hasidism in the work, we say greater is the light that comes from the darkness. Right? Not greater is light, but greater is the light that comes from the darkness. And so what I'm trying to kind of play with is that levels of consciousness transcend and include each other.
They do.
They don't transcend and exclude.
They do.
So therefore,
they absolutely include.
Right? So I've got to hold sweetness and separation,
oh, yeah,
level two and level three, together.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the gorgeous play.
Yes.
That's exciting.
That's exciting.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Arms stand up.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
This is beautiful. Beautiful.
Yes.
This is beautiful. If I can say, with your permission, right, I've rarely seen a more powerful, gorgeous expression of sweetness, hamtaka, consciousness in the world. It's a critical level of consciousness. People are lost in the second level of consciousness, which we need, as we've just said.
Well, we need it because we have it, and it's a good thing.
We need it because it's a face of God.
Yes.
We need it because it's a face of God.
Yeah, what isn't?
Everything is a face of God. All perspectives are a face of God, of course. And there's also expressions of a defaced God in the world, right?
You know, would be any protest.
Would be any evil, right? you see, it's not, I mean, it's total fun, right? And it's total fun when I mean deep fun.
Yes.
Deep, gorgeous, sacred fun. In other words, whenever you bring an example, even in this conversation intuitively, you bring an example from the normal lives that people around the world live, who all are trapped in their minds in the same kinds of ways. And those are primarily the examples in the book.
Yes.
The examples I always bring, right, are from the edges of reality, right, where evil actually breaks through, the normal life is swept aside, right, and terrible, terrible, terrible evil plays.
Yes.
Now, it's true. You know, what was that movie that now just won an Oscar? Capote.
Crash or Capote.
Crash and Capote, they both are, right, Capote. So I actually saw Capote after the Oscars. And I apologize that I fell asleep towards the end, but at least where I was in the movie, he's basically making friends in this very kind of beautiful, complex way with this terrible killer, right? Now, that's sweetness. In other words, he's not just a terrible killer. Actually, there's something else going on here.
Yes.
That's the level of sweetness.
Yes.
And at the same time, you know, the only moral response to Nazi Germany was to fight a war. That war involved violence. That wasn't because we were trapped in our thoughts, right? It's because the right thing to do at that point, right, was actually to fight Nazi Germany. If we hadn't done that, right, we wouldn't be having this conversation, you know, et cetera.
Yes.
So that's the holding both. There are things that aren't what they should be. And it's human dignity to be able to say things should be a certain way. The shadow of that is when people kind of claim I'm right, you're wrong, and use it in a kind of false way, just like the shadow of sexuality is pornography. But the core notion that actually we are able to make judgments in the world, right, and we can participate with God in the healing of the world, and that is our invitation, right, that stands together with the work, and they kind of live in complement.
Yes.
Does that feel right?
Yes.
You're just telling me that.
No.
Promise?
I can't promise that I won't ever. But
okay, but not now.
But not now.
I mean,
it's not my usual.
You're the sweetest of the sweetest of the sweet.
Thank you.
I mean, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is a beautiful conversation.
Yes.
Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
I hope that you and the work felt totally honored in it, even as we kind of work
Absolutely.
For ideas.
Absolutely, I feel honored just meeting you. It's a privilege to meet someone who loves mankind so much that they would give their life to it.
It's an honor to meet you, someone who spreads sweetness and frees people from the great dungeons of thought.
Thank you.
As a great knight of faith.
You know, I tell the story of the snake and the rope, and it's like walking through the desert, and you're terrified of snakes. It's an incredibly beautiful day. The sun is shining. It's beautiful. Mm. Couldn't be better. Mm. You look down, and in front of you is this great, big, fat, poisonous rattlesnake. And you jump back, and you're paralyzed with fear, and your brow is sweating, and your heart is beating. And maybe the cloud moves a different way, and the sun hits it differently. And you see that it wasn't a snake after all. It was a rope. So then I invite people to stand over the rope for 1,000 years and try to make themselves afraid of it again. And they can't, it's not possible, because they have realized for themselves what is true. They've realized reality, not what they thought about reality. Mm-hmm. So when reality is realized, wherever that is, the fear is gone. So I say that every problem in the world is a rope without exception. So let's say the snake bites you and there's no one for miles around. There's no help. So the snake bites you and you're very allergic to the venom.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the thought, I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's no one to help me.
Mm-hmm.
Or basically, when I walk people through this, the thought is, I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they fear. And so I take them back. And if you put yourself there, like this is actually happening,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to die, is it true? You're going to die. Can you absolutely know that it's true? Then how do you react when you think that thought, you're going to die?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the heart starts pumping. The venom starts flowing,
mm-hmm.
pumping. I mean, you're killing yourself.
And you spread it through your whole body.
Yes. So who would you be without the thought? You know, who would you be if you didn't believe that just in this moment? As beautiful a reality as before you came upon the snake. So I'm going to die, turned around, I'm not going to die. Now that runs very deep. What does it mean, I'm not going to die, even after death? So what happens is they're not costing themselves the last moment of their life. They're finally living it. So that's why I say every problem, even when the snake bites us, is a snake. I mean, it's a rope without exception.
Right, right. Yeah. That is a stunningly beautiful expression.
Well, it's like the little girl crawling out of the grave.
It's the most beautiful expression of hamtaka, of sweetness consciousness. I mean, it's not by accident that you chose the snake, because of course the snake, right? I mean, there's always the beauty and the beast, right? So who's the beauty and the beast? So if the beauty, which is the feminine, stays with the beast long enough, right, then the beast is transformed, right? The princess kisses the frog and she's transformed. If you don't slay the dragon, can you imagine if we gave orange juice to the dragon, right? I mean, that's hugely true. And that shadow that we've made a shadow, I mean, what is it, Peter Pan? How does Peter Pan start? Wendy, right? He's flying around the room and he's looking for a shadow. And he needs the beauty, right, which is Wendy, the kind of feminine, the goddess, right, to help him kind of sew his shadow on. And so in biblical consciousness, right, it's the snake, or the dragon's the snake, right? And so what did Adam say to the snake? Nothing. He never talked to the snake. He just wanted to kill the snake. Right? Eve has this conversation with the snake, and yet biblical consciousness is about protest, so therefore Eve becomes a villain. In Kabbalah, the very word snake itself, you know, in Hebrew, every letter has numerical value. So according to the numerical value of the word snake equals the word Messiah, right? Which is exactly your Dharma Torah, right? Snake becomes for the Kabbalah Messiah, because Kabbalah is all about sweetness consciousness. It's about talk to the snake. Snake has something to say to you, right? The one thing you can do is transform your last moment into being fully present and alive at that moment.
And then you owe it to the snake.
And you clearly owe it to the snake, right, who is within you. And at the same time, you hold this other level of consciousness, which is about, you know, the greatest slave driver is the belief that yesterday determines today, and to become free is to know that nothing that happened yesterday determines today. I'm completely free. I can challenge all of reality, right? Because I'm part of that reality, right? So it's like, it's not that there's my business, your business, and God's business, which of course, you know, is a beautiful possibility. But in non-duality, in real sweetness, your business, what kind of is my business?
Well, it always is anyway.
Right, because we're all part of God, and God's business is my business also. Yeah.
But I mean, in all of it, it's true.
In all of it, it's true.
Uh-huh.
In all of it, it's true.
Yeah.
Right.
I just cannot separate myself from you. That's not possible.
Right.
You know,
I would die.
I hit a place where, well, you'd die to me, and that wouldn't help me because you are me. But I hit that place where there was, it was like all the pain was gone. All the suffering was gone, and I could see how it could not be constructed again, that it was not possible.